All right, Malachi 4. You got anything to say, Bill?
Malachi chapter 3, we saw the prophecy of John the Baptist, which was also a prophecy of the Messiah, the Lord come into his temple, which could only have been fulfilled in the time of Christ. If you think about when Malachi had written, that can't be a prophecy of any king or any worldly emperor. It could only be a prophecy of Christ. All of the kings of Judah were no more in Jerusalem at that time, and they were expressly told that they would never rule in Jerusalem again. That was the prophecy to Jeconiah, the king of Judah, as part of his punishment, that his seed would never sit on the throne again. And Christ has the throne now, but Christ wasn't really a direct descendant of Jeconiah's sons. He had inherited the throne from Joseph, who was his more or less adopted father or stepfather. Adopted father is probably the better term, because Yahweh was his father. So the prophecy to Jeconiah came through. So the Lord will come into his temple must be a prophecy of Christ himself. And from there, there's sort of a dual prophecy that he would rebuke the devourer, that Yahweh would rebuke the devourer and certain other chastisements if the children of Israel refused to tithe what he expected from them. And if they did tithe what he expected from them, then he would rebuke the devourer or whatever hampers them or chastises them. There's something here that I'm going to talk about in relation to Malachi chapter 4, verse 1, and that's where it says, "And now we called the proud happy." Yeah, they that work, wickedness are set up. Yeah, they that tempt God are even delivered. And of course, whenever our people don't do what they're supposed to do, that's the setting up of the devourer. That's the enemy rises above us when we are not obedient to our God. We see that situation all over the world today in all Christian nations where Christians have become disaffected and apathetic towards their God and his expectations and have gotten into all sorts of sin. And now the proud are happy and all those that work wickedness are set up. And when I say the proud are happy, I'm sort of making a pun on that gay pride concept. But it's actually an aspect of that. It really is. And that word proud there is spelled Z-D, and it could mean proud or arrogant or insolent or presumptuous. So we're going to see that word or a form of it in Malachi chapter 4, verse 1. So that's important to note here. They that feared the Lord spake often to one another, and the Lord hearkened, or Yahweh hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared Yahweh and that thought upon his name. And I would relate that book of remembrance to the scripture, to the New Testament, the New Covenant. And I don't remember if it was Joe or Noble last week that related that to the New Testament in a very succinct way, because it says that Christ had come in Luke several times and also in Romans and other passages that Christ had come to keep the promises, that Yahweh was remembering the promises and the covenants that he made with the patriarchs. And that's the reason why Christ came. That's the basis for his entire ministry, is to keep the promises which Yahweh made to the patriarchs, and to remember them is to observe them, and that's a very good cross reference to this Book of Remembrance here. That's also a prophecy of the gospel of Christ. And they shall be mine, saith Yahweh of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels and I will spare them, speaking about those people whom he has this remembrance for, the children of Israel who inherited the promises of the patriarchs of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Noble made a good observation, I believe, last week, where he said that is when I make up my jewels, that's symbolic of the wedding supper of the Lamb, of the groom, and the adornment of a bride in fulfillment of the promise to betroth Israel forever after Yahweh had put Israel away in Hosea chapters 1 and 2, and that's very succinct. It's also, I would say that harkens, or it evokes images of the kingdom of God, the city of God, come down from heaven in Revelation chapter 22, and its walls are made of precious stones, which are what jewels consist of. So I think that's also a good analogy there. In Malachi chapter 4, we're going to see what Christ had meant about Elijah already having come, and then he made a statement that alludes to the fact that Elias would come again, that spirit of Elias had already been there, and with that he's referring to John the Baptist, but then that Elias is going to come again and shall go before him in spirit and power. This is in Luke, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for Yahweh. That was in part John the Baptist's ministry, but it's also in our future, according to the words of Christ. And that's in Matthew chapter 17. In verse 10, and his disciples asked him, saying, when say the scribes that Elias must first come? And Jesus answered, I'm reading a King James, and Jesus answered and said to them, Elias truly shall come first and restore all things. But so that's a future. Christ is looking to the future when he says that. But I say unto you that Elias has already come, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatever they listed or whatever they wished. And likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. So John the Baptist was killed by the enemies, by the Edomite Judeans, and Christ would be suffer at their hands also. But those first two responses, that Elias truly shall first come, looks to something far in the future. And here in Malachi chapter 4, it's very clear what that restoration of all things is. It's a restoration of the knowledge of the children of Israel and the turning of their hearts to the fathers. Well, they have to know who they are before their hearts are turned to the fathers. It's that simple. You can't turn your heart to somebody else's father. That doesn't make any sense. And that man's inheritance isn't necessarily yours. It has no connection to you. That's all I have to say about leading into Malachi chapter 4 that I could think of momentarily.
And the father and mother of John the Baptist, well, his mother's name was Elizabeth, which is God of the oath, and his father's name means Zacharias, means Yahweh remembers. So God remembers his promises. So we're talking about John the Baptist. That's another thing to keep in mind.
Yes, that's good.
And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith Yahweh of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves in the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith Yahweh of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of Yahweh. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse.
Very short chapter, but it's a very powerful chapter. This first verse, I want to read it from the Septuagint, and I'm going to talk for a minute about the meanings of two particular words and how they're spelled and how they could easily be confused. In the Septuagint, Malachi chapter 4, verse 1 doesn't say that the proud shall burn as an oven. It says that all the aliens shall burn as an oven in the Septuagint. For behold, a day comes, and Brenton's translation is fair. For behold, a day comes burning as an oven, and it shall consume them, and all the aliens and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day is coming, shall set them on fire, saith the Lord Almighty, and there shall not be left of them root or branch. And that's a promise of the Christian gospel, as well as the more ancient prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, that all of the enemies of Israel and all of the aliens, the other races, are going to burn in a fire. That's the parable of the sheep and the goats, that are nations that are separated on side, these nations. That's the words of Christ in Matthew chapter 25. So this is consistent with that. The difference between the King James Version, where it has this word proud, and the Septuagint, where it has a word allogenes, which actually means other races, and Brenton translated it as aliens. But allogenes is a very particular word which means other races, except that the Greeks use that word race in a somewhat narrower sense than we use it today. And there's a historical reason for that. To the Greeks, a race could be a subdivision of a nation, but a nation was a homogeneous people of the same origins. But a race could be identified as a subdivision of a nation. So that's even true of the children of Israel, where you had Jacob had 12 sons, and each son was the father of a peculiar tribe. And the women in that tribe were told in the law in Deuteronomy to marry a man of their own tribe. And if they married a man from one of the other tribes, that their inheritance, if they inherited anything from their father, if they had no brothers, then their inheritance could not leave the tribe. They would lose it to their other male folk. So it was better for a woman to marry someone of her own tribe if she was going to keep her inheritance, even among the 12 tribes of Israel. So the Greeks, from their viewpoint, the way they use that word race, would have considered each one of those tribes a race, even though they were the same general race. They all came from the race of Isaac or the race of Abraham before Jacob. They would consider each one of those 12 tribes a race. And that's just the way the Greeks used the word. But it also referred to the wider race. It was often used of the race of the Hellenes, which are the Greeks themselves. Even though Greeks were made up of several different tribes, they were all rather homogeneous and had the same language and customs and territory which they shared. So the Greeks used that word in a flexible manner, but they would never take anybody that was a clear racial alien and imagine them to be of the same race as the Greeks, not even a Persian. Even though the Persians were of the same water race, they wouldn't even consider a Persian. So, and there's other reasons for that, such as laws and customs, that the Persians were alienated from them for a long, long time. So they were a different race. We know from history that the European nations, in their original form, before any of the Muslim invasions or any of the modern race mixing that's been going on, the European nations were actually a collection of nations descended from the children of Israel for the most part, and some of the related peoples of Genesis 10. So we could consider them the same race in the broad sense of the term, and also sub-races in the narrow Greek sense of the term, and both ways would be proper. So the children of Israel were one nation with many tribes within it, but it grew into one tribe, basically, of many nations. So it flipped that definition over, if you see what I mean. But this allogenes can't refer to any of them. It must refer to races that are alien or just completely different from the children of Israel. The reason for this difference in the writing is that the word proud is Zed, and it's spelled Z-D. And the word stranger, these Septuagint translators must have read that Z-D, not as Z-D, but as Z-R, or stranger, which is an alien. And I'll explain the meaning for that in a few moments. But there is a lot of confusion in the Old Testament scriptures, and it's demonstrable in many places. Confusion between the Zed and the Resh. I'm sorry, between the Daleth or D and the Resh or the R. They look almost totally the same, the D and the R, in the modern Hebrew script. So when you see it in computer typeface, the Resh has like a curved angle and the Daleth has a straight angle, like a right angle. And they both make a 90 degree angle, but the Resh is a little more curved and the Daleth is like two lines that intersect at the corner and it's straight. And that's how it is in computer typeface. But that's not how it is in handwriting. And in handwriting, the two letters are very easy to confuse. And there's a lot of examples of that in the Hebrew Old Testament when it's translated into Greek or into English. It could be demonstrated. So here is a case in the Septuagint of that confusion between the Daleth or D and the Resh or the R. There's another problem here, and I'm not even going to, and I lean towards the Septuagint understanding of the word very clearly. It goes with Jeremiah and prophecies in Isaiah and other prophets, and also in the words of Christ in the Revelation and in the parable of the wheat and the tares, the parable of the fish and the net, the parable of the sheep and the goats, and other statements of Christ. So the way the Septuagint reads here, that all the aliens are going to be burnt in a fire, is very much consistent with all the other scriptures. Christ came to forgive the sins of the children of Israel. A lot of the children of Israel are proud, but their sins are going to be forgiven. So this proud word...
You're breaking up a bit, Bill.
I'm sorry?
We missed what you said about the parable of the net and that. You broke up a little bit, so.
I'm sorry. This the way the Septuagint reads in Malachi chapter 4, verse 1, it's consistent with prophecies in Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 11, for instance, with prophecies in Isaiah and some of the other prophets, and also in the parable of the net, in the parable of the sheep and the goats, the parable of the wheat and the tares, and Revelation chapter 19. It's all consistent. So Malachi 4, verse 1 in the Septuagint agrees with all those prophecies, and also with Obadiah, for verses like 14 through 19, I think, or something like that, where all the other nations eating on Yahweh's holy mountain are going to be destroyed. And that's all these other races that have become elevated, that are set up working wickedness. Because if we want to interpret Malachi consistently, if we accept the Septuagint reading and read aliens instead of proud in Malachi chapter 4, verse 1, because the context of that passage carries over from Malachi chapter 3, verse 15, then where it says, and now we call the proud happy, we'd have to read that, and now we call the stranger happy. Yeah, they that work wickedness are set up. And that is also consistent with what was happening in the time of Malachi, when there were men that were not of the covenant of Levi accepted into the priesthood, as we saw in Malachi chapter 2, where the children of Israel would marry themselves to a strange god, as we saw in Malachi chapter 2, to children, to the daughter of a strange god. So there we see other peoples who are aliens in the kingdom of God, and actually being set up in the kingdom of God, and becoming priests in the kingdom of God. And the Levites are being chastised for that in Malachi chapter 2. So that reading of alien or stranger instead of proud is very consistent with Malachi chapters 2, 3, and 4. I discovered something this evening, which I never looked into before. I wish I'd have done all of this for my Malachi commentary back 5 or 6 years ago, but someday I'm going to expand on this, so I'm saving some notes I made about 15 minutes before this, before I came on with y'all tonight, before I showed up here. I started looking into this word, word zur, and Strong spells this word zur, for some reason, in his concordance, as Zion Vav Resh, Z-V-R, or Z-W-R, as it's usually spelled, instead of just Z-R. And I had looked into this back when I was with probably about a year and a half ago with TruthVids doing the 100 Proofs the Israelites Were White series. And in part 18, I wrote about Strong's number 2114, Zur, and that it's a stranger, as it's defined, meaning an alien. And in Strong's concordance, this word Zur, which is often translated as stranger, Strong's considers it to be a primitive root. In other words, this word has no root. It is a root. But there's another word, Zur, Z-R, which is only spelled Z-R. And it's Strong's number 2213, which refers to something on a border. And Strong's assigns number 2214, which is Zara, and defines it as disgust in the sense of estrangement. So you would be disgusted with somebody from outside of your borders coming to your land and sharing in your communion, or trying to take advantage and live off your land. You would be disgusted with that. It would repulse you, and you would push that individual out of your border, which is natural, and that behavior is coded into this Hebrew language very clearly. That's the way life should be. So I think Strong's was really dishonest to take this word Zur 2114, which is stranger, and spell it Z-W-R or Zion Vav Resh. I think it's dishonest because just before this Bible study was supposed to start, I brought up the Hebrew in BibleWorks to look at all of the occurrences where this word is translated as stranger. And in every one of them that I looked at so far, the first up to Proverbs 2:16, from Genesis to Proverbs, it's not spelled Z-W-R. It's spelled Z-R in every one of them. And I have a list here of them. Exodus 29:33, 30:33, Leviticus chapter 22, three times, Numbers chapters 1, 16, 18, twice. In the feminine, Numbers chapter 3 and Numbers chapter 26. There's a lot of occurrences of this word as stranger, and it's always spelled Z-R. So I have to look a lot deeper to see what Strong's motive possibly could have been if he had an honest motive for spelling it in a dictionary as Zion Vav Resh. Because everyone where I saw it translated as stranger is just Zion Resh, Z-R. And if this word was spelled Z-R in Strong's Concordance, this 2114, then it would fall down in the order in the number system, and it would be right next to that word at 2213, which refers to something on a border. And that tells me what this word stranger, this word Zur, means. It means somebody from outside of your borders. That's what it has to mean. So, that being said, the children of Israel were to dwell alone in Palestine. So the Zur stranger is everybody whose origin is from outside of the borders of the children of Israel, which means all the other races, everybody. It doesn't exclude anybody that's of any other race. Because everybody, the children of Israel supposedly dwelling alone, everybody is from outside of their borders. I think that Strong's really did us a disservice spelling this word Zion Vav Resh in his concordance. And I have to do a deeper study and find examples of that, or see if there's examples of that in Hebrew. But I couldn't find one for 15 or 20 minutes before I showed up at the Bible study tonight. I looked and I couldn't find one. They were all just Z-R, Z-R, Z-R. I'm up to Proverbs. I want to check the rest of the passages, but I don't think I'm going to find one. I may not. And it almost seems to me like Strong's had an agenda or something.
Yeah, to hide the truth. That's a really good find, too.
Yeah, it is.
I just have to finish the research, the footwork or the legwork, but I might write on this in the near future. I'm going to save these notes. I probably ain't going to get to it this week, but I don't know what I'm doing for a podcast yet this week. I don't think I'm going to be up to a Genesis podcast, but I won't know until the morning, which is when I typically start writing my Friday night podcast on Thursday morning. So I might just do something topical this week. I already have a list of topics half written on. That would be a lot easier and less demanding on me. So we'll see. I'm surprised I could talk that long without choking my head off or coughing my head off again. I cough myself to a headache every couple of minutes, especially when I'm laying down, when I'm trying to sleep. So last night I had about 5 hours sleep. I started coughing so hard that I kept waking Melissa up, and I just came downstairs to my desk and started working on something so that she could sleep at like 5 a.m. So that's all right.
Yeah, well, good on you, Bill.
So
letting your wife sleep. Yeah, that's interesting. So anyone outside the border would be treated with disgust, and that's a natural response.
Yes.
And Strong's was hiding that because
connected. 2114 and 2213 and 2214. And Strong says 2214 is Zara, which it defines as disgust in the sense of estrangement. But Strong's gives the root of that word back to Zor 2114, Zion Vavresh, ignoring 2214 or 2213, I'm sorry. And 2213, Strong's defines it and I just studied this word a little more too, but I'm sure I'm right about it. Strong's defines it as from 2237 in the sense of scattering. Well, let's see what 2237 means. Zarar, a primitive root, perhaps to diffuse. Perhaps, he says. So he doesn't even really know, right? And then he defines it as a chaplet or spread around the top of something. And then, i.e. specifically, a border molding. Well, you know what? A border is a molding. It's a molding around your land. It's an area that's marked off. And I would say that this word, that the focus of the meaning of this word is really a border. So I want to study that a little more and look through how all these words are used. But the meaning, the basic meaning of the word is clearly a border. And Zara is discussed in the sense of estrangement. And he said that himself, and that he's not connecting this word Zor to border. He's only saying it's a stranger, but he's not telling you why. He's calling it a primitive root. Well, it means stranger. There's like five or six different words in Hebrew that can mean stranger that are translated as stranger in the King James Version. But they all have their own nuance of meaning. They all do, like a ger isn't really a stranger, a ger is a sojourner. Well, Zor, it's very clear to me, is a stranger because it's somebody from the border. Somebody who came over your border. It has to be.
I wonder how many little things like this have escaped our notice. I'm sure there's more.
Well, I've been at this 25 years, and I just learn this, what I did, mostly when I did Truth Vids, when I prepared for his 100 proofs that the Israelites were white, but I think I did a little work on it earlier, like a year or so before that, in one of my podcasts, one of my presentations on the word stranger in Hebrew. So it wasn't really original when I did Truth Vids, but it really isn't that old that I've begun to develop this argument, right? It's only the last couple of years.
I can't speak to what his objectives were, like Strong's, but sometimes you open up these dictionaries and you can just see the altruism like seeping off the pages, like in some definitions.
Absolutely, and Strong's had that altruism, and he had a lot of church doctrine. And he was probably partially blinded by that. And he was probably partially blinded by some rabbi he learned Hebrew from. Who the hell knows?
Likely, yeah. Possible.
These guys somewhere along the way had to turn to Jewish sources to understand Hebrew. So another thing I'll do when I do a more complete study on this particular word, because it's going to take a couple of days to put it all together, right? It is go through Brown Driver Briggs and Jacenius at all three definitions and see what they say about them. But I'm already fairly confident that I'm correct, that this 2114 Zor should have been spelled without the Vav. And then if some uses had the vav, well, that's all right. And there's a lot of Hebrew words like that that are spelled both ways, with and without the vav, or with and without a yod, between two consonants, right? That's not novel at all. So I'll have to see if it's ever used with the vav, and in what kind of contexts it's used with the vav, and if those contexts are really different from where it's not used with the vav, which seems to me to predominate the instances, at least, where it's used as a stranger, because I haven't found one time yet up to Proverbs chapter 2 where it is spelled with the vav and means stranger.
That is some laborious work, but very worthwhile.
Yeah, it's hard to find in Hebrew. Okay, because of the vowel points, it's very difficult to find a word to put a search in for a Hebrew word in Bible works. But I do have a copy of the Hebrew Old Testament that has no vowel points, and I'll have to go to that and search for that letter combination there, that Zion Vav Resh. I'll have to search for that there in the raw Hebrew, which I have.
What's that one called, Bill? Each
book up individually, because it's not all together. I'm sorry, Joe. I thought Joe said something. Maybe I'm wrong.
He did.
So, what's I'm convinced Hebrew? That this word Zor is stranger, and it's Z-R. It is many times in Scripture, and I've checked them. And that's stranger, because it's somebody from outside your borders. And that Malachi chapter 4:1, because that's the way they read it when they translated the Septuagint, they read it as an alien and not as the proud, right? So Malachi 4:1 and also Malachi 3:15, where it says proud, it should really say aliens. And that's consistent with the prophecies in Malachi chapters 1 and 2.
I have something else to talk on, if that's okay.
That's only what I want to say about Malachi chapter 1, but chapter 4, verse 1, but that's okay. Go on.
Yeah, I thought of it when you were talking about verse 6 and referencing the angel when the angel announced the birth of John the Baptist to Zechariah. And I haven't thought of this before, but it reminded me, and we're all familiar with this, Luke, when Yahshua announces his ministry in Nazareth, and they bring him the scroll, and he goes to this passage in Isaiah, and he announces his ministry, and he cuts short of the part where it says he's going to have vengeance, because that was not the objective of his first advent. And I think something similar happened here in Malachi when the angel announced the coming birth of John the Baptist, because the angel, when it's speaking to Zechariah, it doesn't mention the heart of the children to their fathers. It says, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children. It doesn't mention the other side of that. And if you think about it, John the Baptist, his ministry never expanded beyond the borders of Palestine. His objective really wasn't racial awakening. That wasn't his objective. And while Paul did that in his epistles, he turned the hearts of the children to the fathers. You know, looking back, John the Baptist really didn't do that. So it makes a lot of sense that the angel cuts short and doesn't mention the heart of the children to their fathers, because everybody whom John the Baptist associated with in Palestine, they knew their genealogy, right? They knew they were Israelites. Paul, when he's writing to certain peoples, they might not be as aware, and Paul had to educate them. But John the Baptist, the people he fraternized with and taught, they knew who they were. So he didn't have to turn the hearts of the children to their fathers. But we do, and that's the third ministry of Elijah. That's us today. But in reference to the second ministry of Elijah, the angel cuts short. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds valid. I mean, I couldn't argue with that at all. That sounds valid because Yahweh gives us information as we need to know it on a need-to-know basis, definitely. The children of Israel that were in Judea at the time of John the Baptist really know what they needed to repent from. They were victims of their circumstances, like we all are, but to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, I don't even really know if he fulfilled that, if that isn't included, but the angel said it would be. To the hearts, to the fathers, to the children sort of looks forward to the future, that the Messiah has come and we should consider the future in the context of the coming of the Messiah. Do you see what I mean?
I think that is basically how John the Baptist would have fulfilled that. Preparing like the path, the way for a new era.
Yes. Well, that was a lot of the purpose of the gospel. Yes. Looking forward to the
kingdom, really.
The reconciled Christ, life with God, looking forward to that future, is turning the hearts of the fathers to the children, making them think about their future and their children and how they're going to be raised and what their estate is going to be.
And you see that in the ministry of Christ, like in Mark, one of the first things, or maybe even the first thing Christ is recorded as saying in Mark's gospel is, behold, the kingdom of the heavens has neared, or the kingdom of heaven has neared. So like it's you're looking future, right? And then in the Old Testament, there's very little dialogue on the kingdom, very little of it.
Well, the Old Testament is a model of the kingdom.
It is, and it's a parable in that sense. I know Paul compared, they called it.
But it only lasted for three kings. A bunch of judges and three kings, right? Saul, David, and Solomon. After that, it was over. No more kingdom. It was divided.
And you see that both kingdoms are established in the same way. They're both established through violence. Right, Joshua leading them, treading down the wicked, and we see here in Malachi, we will tread down the wicked again, being led by another Joshua. So they're both like ushered in the same way, except the first kingdom we sort of failed.
Well, right, and that's why Paul of Tarsus in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 said that every thought should be on Christ, and that we would have an opportunity to avenge all disobedience once our obedience is fulfilled. I know it seems like we're an awful long way from that, but something tells me that at some point in the future, it's going to happen really quick.
Yeah, sort of like an avalanche, you know? Like when an avalanche happens, you don't see all the little details that are leading towards this avalanche. But once that last piece of snow moves, it's all at once. It's like huge. There's like little things leading towards it. And then all of a sudden, one day, it might just come down like a storm.
We only pray.
Yeah.
That might be the flood that overtakes us when we make our covenant with hell and death. Well, we've already made our covenant with hell and death as a people. They're still in the covenant with hell and death for the most part.
But if this flood, these flames pass over us and we're still standing in the name of our God, then we turn back and against our enemies. You know, if we can stand as the flood passes over us and we're still standing, that's the end of the enemy after that. Because after that, it's our turn, you know?
Well, that's basically the way Paul of Tarsus described it.
And that's sort of what it's alluding to, I believe, in Genesis, where the serpent only ever gets our heel, right? No matter what they do to us, they only ever get the heel.
Yes.
Because we're moving on somewhere better.
Well, this right, that's world. What Christ said, where I go, you cannot come. So they really can't have them.
This whole world could pass away and we would still stand in the name of our God. This whole world could pass away and it would take the bastards with it. And we see at verse 6 here, it says, unless he turns the hearts of the fathers to the son and the hearts of the father to the hearts of the son to the father, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. You know, they're not going to have any earth if we're not here, because God will destroy, you know, this earth with a curse. The bastards are the curse. You know, we're not going to see, they're not going to have a world of their own.
And you see in Revelation 22, it says, and there is no more curse. So no more curses of disobedience. We're obedient. The world is healed. The garden is clean of all its weeds.
This world was made for us and our people. There's no, you know, it wasn't made for bastards to take over and devour. It wasn't made for vanity.
Yeah, like the bastards, they don't realize that they're just exercise equipment.
Yeah.
Well, they are.
Scaffolding.
Yeah, like it's an exercise in vanity. And they're like the exercise equipment to educate us. And once we're educated, bye-bye.
Yeah. The dross just is taken away. Once you built the building, the scaffolding is torn down.
Exactly. That's a better illustration. Yeah, that's like the building the city of God, and they're the scaffolding in a way.
Okay, I have a few things to say here. That the word says unto you to fear my name, that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. I thought it was really kind of fascinating where Christ said in Matthew, and the word huioi is masculine and it means sons. It doesn't mean children, it means sons. And I'm not discounting women at all, but Christ is speaking of sons here, male. That ye may be the sons of your father, Matthew chapter 5, verse 45. The King James has children. The New American Standard Bible has sons properly. That you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven, for he causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good. And I still think, even though that only works in English, I still have this impression that it's a purposeful play on words that would only work in English. That may be because I speak English natively, but that's how I think about that passage, because now the whole world practically speaks English natively. So that wordplay works.
It does.
Wherever English is, wherever the scripture is read in English. So unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise, and Matthew chapter 5, in order that you may be sons of your Father. Well, that would be those who fear his name, that want that position of sonship, so they're going to be obedient and in awe of him. And for that cause, he causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. But the rain coming on the unrighteous isn't necessarily for their good. It's for Yahweh's good. So like Joe said, they won't survive the flood. Certainly not. And in relation to chapter 4, verse 3 here. And ye shall tread down the wicked. In Obadiah, verse 15, for the day of Yahweh is near upon all the heathen. In the King James, that word means nations. It's goyim. It means nations. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as you have drunk upon my holy mountain, that is an idiom referring to the children of Israel. It's a metaphor for the children of Israel. My holy mountain, or Zion, or the people of God, are his holy mountain, very often in the prophets. So shall all the nations drink continually. They shall drink and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. And that's the cup of the wrath of Yahweh in the Revelation. And that's the cup of Mystery Babylon, that as she has rewarded unto you, reward unto her double. In Revelation chapter 18. I have to look for that. No. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm in a tab where Luther's loaded. Luther's German Bible that I was looking at today. And now my Bible Works is just crashing.
Yeah, well, when Yahweh chastises us, it's for our correction. But when he doesn't chastise the non-whites, he just destroys them. And so first he uses them to chastise us, and then they're taken away and destroyed. They get their cup of wrath.
That's the pattern throughout the entire Old Testament. That's the pattern where the Assyrians, with the rod of his anger, in Isaiah, I think that's in Isaiah chapter 6 or chapter 8, I forget, or chapter 10, they would a rod of his anger, and that's in an oracle that Yahweh is telling the Assyrians that he's going to destroy Assyria. And he's going to use his people to destroy Assyria in Isaiah chapter 10. That the children of Israel are going to be among those who destroy Assyria. And that happened in history when the Scythians and the Cimmerians had been involved with the Persians and the Medes to destroy Assyria.
The Assyrians were probably like, oh, we're winning. We're doing great. We're going to trample these Hebrews down. We're winning big time. And then all of a sudden, the tides turn and Yahweh destroys them. So in the moment, they're probably pretty happy and they probably think they're doing pretty good, like the Jews probably think they're doing pretty good today. But it's all just for Yahweh. Like you said, Bill. What did you say, Noble?
There's a great verse in the second psalm. And the theme of that psalm is Christ and his governance, and these aliens don't want him to be king, and certain rulers of the nations are encouraged to be obedient towards the Christ. And there's a great verse in there because it sort of reminds me of Revelation 19, where there's the man on the horse and his army, and that's Christ, and then all the others, the aliens, are trying to stand against him and his army. And then in the second psalm, it's a similar picture of like an army or Christ, you know, Yahweh and his anointed, and they're trying to stand against him. And they're like, oh, we got to cast his yoke off from us. You know, we have to resist them. And it just says, Yahweh will laugh them to scorn or something like that. And then it goes on to speak about their destruction, their utter destruction. Yeah. And there's several verses like that.
Who would not?
The Bible.
Yeah, like who in the New Testament, in Luke, who would not that I should reign over them? Come hither and slay them before me.
Yeah, and that's a perfect cross-reference to the second psalm. And I have that cross-referenced in my notes because that parable from Luke, it's about the future. It's about Christ coming back and rewarding men for what they did. Like every man has a different amount of minas, right? So it's a second Advent parable. So it makes sense. He's alluding to his warrior and Messiah manifestation right there in the Gospels.
I love saying Christ is king now because it makes the Jews kevitch. they'll get really upset if you say Christ is king. And it's like, oh, you don't accept Christ as king? Well, Luke 19:27.
Yeah, Luke 19:27. Yeah. And that's a prophecy. And it's a beautiful one.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, you know, in the 110th Psalm, it says the people will be willing in the day of your power. And that's us being obedient. And all these aliens, they're going to freak out. They don't want Christ to come and issue this worldwide governance over the earth. They don't want that.
I think
they'll be killed. Like, they're going to be killed anyways, but they won't want it. They're going to be killed.
I think Bill mentioned it, like, when your obedience is fulfilled, avenge all disobedience. And, you know, their existence is disobedience.
And that's, I found the verse I wanted in Revelation. In Revelation 18:3, we read, "For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication," speaking about the whore sitting on the beast, Mystery Babylon, the whore being the children of Israel. And that's a, I don't want to go into that whole thing to prove that, but the woman in Revelation chapter 12, which fled into the wilderness, became the whore of Revelation chapter 17, which handed her kingdom over to the beast. And that's Mystery Babylon. And now in Revelation chapter 18, Babylon is going to fall. "For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication," the woman who committed whoredom with the beast. And it mentions the merchants of the earth and how they've waxed rich through that. And then in verse 4, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins." And then in verse 6, "Those who come out of her, reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her, double according to her works." That is a picture which corresponds with that passage in Obadiah about all the nations drinking on Yahweh's holy mountain, that as they drank, it's they're going to swallow down, and they shall be as though they have not been, because they're going to drink from that cup of wrath, the cup of the wrath of Yahweh, that his people who are still here and come out of Mystery Babylon when it falls, that his people have a hand in executing.
And that's the fire come down from heaven, in a sense, because we're born from above. And yes, you can cross-reference that right to Obadiah.
Right after that, the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame.
In Revelation 2, it's Jezebel who taught his servants to fornicate. And Jezebel was serving in the government at the time. She was an idolater who served in the government. She could have been an Israelite. So the government is teaching people to commit fornication. And
the government
forces
it on people now.
It does.
All of our governments are forcing on people.
And that goes deeper into the Elijah type. There's a lot of layers to the Elijah type. And the first Elijah, he was a prophet and a man of God during a time of great apostasy and great race mixing, where race mixing was being promoted by the government. And the third ministry of Elijah is in the exact same situation.
There was a headline today about a Christian couple that's really upset and complaining in Colorado. I don't know to what extent they're protesting this, but it seemed like they were protesting it very firmly. That's all I can say because I haven't read it. Melissa showed it to me tonight. And they're in Colorado, and their daughter, they're a white couple, and their high school age daughter on a class trip was forced to share a bed with a transgender woman.
Public school,
and I guess she did it. I mean, I would rather she slept on the floor, right? But I guess she did it, and now her parents are really up in arms about it. But this is the schools, and the schools are an agency of the government, and they're forcing these kids to do these things, and it's disgusting.
Yeah.
That's gross. I'm surprised the parents cared. You know, in this day and age, I'm surprised they even cared.
Right. Well, they described them as a Christian couple, so yeah, they must be Christian enough to care.
Yeah. Well, that's good. But they should take their daughter out of public school.
If they were really Christians and they knew what those schools taught, they should never have them in there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. There's no value to it whatsoever. You're not losing anything, but you're gaining everything.
Well, here we have in Malachi 4, "Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and the judgments. That's the laws of Leviticus chapters 18, 19, 20, 21 that the children of Israel had agreed to keep. And here at this future time that Christ spoke about, that Elijah shall come, we see the next line: behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of Yahweh. And part of that, turning the heart of the fathers to the children, and especially the heart of the children to the fathers, is to remember the law and to keep the law. In verse 1. They're not separate ideas. They're the same idea. Just like Christ said, if you love me, keep my commandments. That's the commandments that he was referring to. And most Christians today think, oh, he means the Ten Commandments. No, he means those commandments back there in Leviticus and Exodus.
And didn't Christ say that, like, brotherly love hangs on the law and the prophets? Like, loving your brother is keeping the law. So turning... Yes. The hearts of the children to the fathers, that would be keeping the law. That's brotherly love, because that's what brotherly love is keeping the law.
Yeah, it is. Everything that's in the law revolves around loving God and loving your brethren, everything.
Right.
And John writes in his first epistle that, yeah, loving your brethren fulfills the law. And that's what John means by that. Because if you love your brethren, you're not going to transgress those laws. You're not going to cheat them.
Right. Cheat them, cheat with your wives, cheat them in any way whatsoever, steal from them. Any way whatsoever, short them on their wages, whatever.
And like Bill was saying, here in Malachi, it shows us that the law is still relevant. I mean, there's hundreds of verses, but this is another one. And all these people who think that, these Judeos who think that the law was done away with, they really don't understand the purpose of the law. They think the law is just like God... like went into a random number generator or picked out some laws out of the hat and just chose random nonsensical laws for arbitrary reasons that don't really mean anything at all.
And some of those laws were mean, Noble. So, you know, meanness means that you can just forget about them and be like, nice instead.
And I know it's funny, but like a law represents an eternal truth. Like, sure, the rituals of the law, they were contingent upon things, and they can change, right? That's done away with. But moral laws, how does that change? Why would it be immoral for you to do something yesterday, but it's moral today? Like, why would God, what? Because if it's moral today, then why did God ever forbid you in the first place, except for some arbitrary, nonsensical reason? And when they think this way, they basically assume that God gave the law for just weird reasons that make no sense. It's all arbitrary. They don't understand that the law is about loving God and your brethren, and all of that benefits yourself and your community.
And they want to hope it's arbitrary because they believe in relativism. All humanists are steeped in relativism, that something could be okay in one age and even though it was rejected in past ages, right? But they don't, yeah, you know, they preach Paul of Tarsus all the time, but they don't preach what Paul taught about the law, except to say that it was done away with. Oh, Colossians chapter 2. They end it there. Oh, it was nailed to the cross. But no, because Paul also wrote 1 Corinthians. The same Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, and he said that fornicators, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, so fornication and adultery are two different things, nor the effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind. What is that? That's the word, the Greek word arsenokoites, and it only means one thing. For a man to have sex with other males. That's all it means. That's all it can possibly mean, or is for a man to have sexual intercourse with another man. Nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God. The only place you see laws against all those things are back there in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy.
Then, you know, when we say the law was nailed to the cross, that doesn't really mean it's done away with. That sort of, it's more because Christ is the final sacrifice, so we don't need the priesthood offering sacrifices anymore. It doesn't, that's why it's only that part of the law that's, you know, in quote, right, done away with. It wasn't really done away with, it was fulfilled in a more perfect way. So it's not like, oh, you can just do whatever you want now. It's more like, no, we just don't need the sacrifices anymore because Christ is the final sacrifice, and any further sacrifices you make would be kind of like saying he's not good enough, wouldn't it? So that's why that part's done away with. It's not the whole law.
But that's exactly the way Paul described it in Hebrews, in his epistle to the Hebrews. I think it's mostly illustrated in chapter 9, perhaps, but it's throughout Hebrews. The fact that Christ is the final sacrifice, that the Levitical high priest had to sacrifice once a year, but Christ had one sacrifice for all time. And Paul said that. He said those things explicitly in that same manner. But they don't want to cross-reference. They want to read what they read in the scripture, which is convenient for them. They don't want to cross-reference Colossians chapter 2 and Paul's words in Hebrews.
And here at verse 5, it's saying the law will stand until the day of the Lord comes, because remember the law of my servant Moses. And then at verse 5, and behold, I will send you Elias. And, you know, and so the law is standing until the Lord comes.
I really wish they saw the law the same way we do, because they just see it as a bunch of like burdens that Yahweh puts on the shoulders of men. And that's not at all what it is. I wish they could see it as something beautiful.
Brotherly love.
Like, when I look at the law, I'm just like, yeah, this is beautiful. Like, I can see God is perfect when I read the law. But when they read the law or they think of the law, they just think of it as a bunch of burdens. Oh, gosh. Like, I hate that attitude. I really do. And you see Judeos, they would say to you, like, oh, I don't think that way. But they really actually do.
And more like telling just a man not to sleep with another man's wife, that shouldn't be seen as a burden.
Yeah.
No.
Telling a man not to sleep with another man, that should not be seen as a burden. That should just be considered normal.
Right. Yeah, and John, doesn't John say, like, beloved, the commandments of Yahweh are not burdensome? I think he does.
I do know what you mean, though, about a lot of people out in the world thinking that that's draconian. What do you mean I can't sleep with somebody else's wife? What if she wants it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's a better way to say it. Yeah, that's what I was talking about, those people.
That's why all the stuff's going on in the churches is going on today. The CI teaching is the only teaching that makes you feel personally responsible and want to obey the laws. The teaching in the churches, okay, is falling away from the law and doing as you please.
Right. And the pastors are the first ones to go screwing around.
Exactly. And this puts the responsibility in your lap, and you want it in your lap when you know this. But when you go in the Judeo churches, this doesn't matter. You do as you please.
It's easy to keep the law. I mean, most of the law is very easy to keep. You don't have to go out of your way to keep it. You just don't screw anybody else's wife. You screw your own wife. You don't steal anything from anybody. It's easy not to steal. It's really easy not to steal. It is. To just respect another man's property.
You know, and how hard is it not to bow before a false god, Bill?
Right. It might be harder than we think, because we have all these men watching these sports games 8 hours a day, every weekend, Monday nights, Thursday nights, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. They're worshiping idols, basically.
And the preacher's promoting it from the pulpit.
Yes. They're just as big a sports tards as their audience, usually, as their congregation. It's insane. So, yeah, so they're not, maybe they're not going out and bowing down to pieces of wood, stone, but they're basically worshiping idols.
Yeah, they bound to a nigger with a pigskin in his hand.
It's just so subtle that they don't understand what they're doing. People, I've seen people so emotionally invested in whether their team, which they don't own and which they have absolutely no commercial or financial interest in, but their team has to win the Super Bowl or their team has to win the game Sunday. And they get emotionally invested in that. Melissa and I have been out on a Monday, and Monday is usually the day I take off. It's the day I've always chosen to take off. And we'll be out, and there'll be some game somewhere, and these people just start screaming when their team scores a touchdown. And they're screaming at the tops of their lungs in a bar 500 miles from the game. It's nuts. They're totally emotionally invested. If they were a fraction of that much invested in God, we'd have so much better a society.
Yeah, imagine being obsessed about God. I wish people were. Zeal.
Well, their team scores a touchdown and they are screaming. Yeah! It's crazy. It's and
they're, I mean, like, they cry.
The 40 to 60 year old set, and they act like little children.
There's always like the footage from like the Super Bowl or like FIFA, and the camera will cut to like old men in the stands legitimately crying, like they're legitimately shedding tears. Like if the team loses the big Super Bowl event or something, like they're legitimately crying.
Yeah.
And in Canada, which is like, there's a stereotype that we're all passive. Well, some years, like people riot in the streets, like for the Stanley Cup. If the team loses the Stanley Cup game or something, there's like miscreants in the street, like trashing cars and shit. They're all drunk and they're trying to vent their anger because to them this is a severe loss.
Let's say though that you live in a small community and you've got your community team and they're all white and like your brother's on the team, and you're sort of invested in the team because it's part of your community spirit, and it could be like that with any organization in your community. But when you see a nigger on TV and it's like Queensland team, and it's like they're not Queenslanders, they're a bunch of niggers, like I feel it real, it's a lot more difficult for me than to support that team. I'm not saying I support sports all the time or anything like that, but I don't understand how men can support a team that has no attachment to their community whatsoever. They've been flown in from some Pacific Island country and put on a Queensland jersey, and it's like, how is that the Queensland team? How is that my community team? You know, if it was your community, like, oh, it's the Hitler Youth and my chapter of the Hitler Youth won the competition against, you know, then you feel like, yeah, I'm part of this. I'm support. Yeah. You know, then I could understand the emotion, but it's like people's emotions are all mixed up and now and being distorted.
Well, that's like camaraderie and like brotherly love. It's not like wearing your favorite player's jersey, having like their flag on your car, legitimately crying over news and shit, religiously checking like roster updates. Like there's a difference. It's sort of like spirit of the law, you know. Like I don't think God doesn't want us to have fun.
Sir, I just wanted to say it's so enormous now, they would lose half their audience if it wasn't for, and that includes all these pools, drafts and so forth you guys do at the office and all that. Because I know from experience, and I had a lot of friends that were into it, they couldn't even stomach to watch a game if they didn't have money on it. So it's also idolatry in a different sense, because what they really want is to win their $100 or $500 of the game.
You know, I got a call when they had Teddy Kennedy's funeral. They was telling me how beautiful the funeral was, and they said, I wonder how much that cost. I told them I could have saved them a lot of money. sent him to me, I'd bury him face down, leave his ass sticking out of the ground where I could park my bicycle in it.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if I want to do that.
You want me to cut this soon? Or?
I think one last thing we had to say, except that verse 6, and he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers. That's a remembrance of the racial covenant, of the covenant with Jacob Israel. Makes no sense in any other context. That is the understanding of the children of Israel as to who they are and who their fathers are. That's the only way you could turn the heart of the children to their fathers. And that's the only way that doing so has any real meaning when you're told to remember the law of Moses, my servant, which is only for the children of Israel, and that ye shall tread down the wicked, which is only for the children of Israel. So all of this is interconnected in this prophecy. You can't separate the passages and interpret them in any different way, except in the context of these other passages. So this is Christian identity. This is the only form of Christianity that's trying to teach people this very thing. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah, we pray that the day comes soon where our brethren realize that they don't have any other choice. There is no second option. I have something to say on verse 2. I don't know how worthy it is for the recording, but today my wife told me that she was reading that farmers, at least in the past, one of the reasons tares were such a nuisance is because tares grow faster than wheat. And because they grow so much faster, they would grow taller than the wheat and start blocking out the wheat's access to the sun. They would cast a shadow over the wheat. The wheat can't get enough sunlight, and the wheat doesn't grow properly. And I can see symbolism in that when we understand the parable. We can understand, okay, if the sun represents Christ, when we have them around, they corrupt us and they inhibit our growth.
That's a good observation.
It's also interesting that the other races grow to maturity faster than white people, generally speaking.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, they breed like a plague, so they reach maturity quicker and then they breed quicker, and then that's how plague animals breed. But more developed and noble creatures have longer gestation periods. They take longer time to develop. Their mothers actually take care of them and nurture them to adulthood, whereas nigger mothers just let their, you know, they'll often leave their kids in the wild and just hope some of them, because it's like a plague. They're playing the plague angle of survival, whereas we're, you know, we have more highly developed and noble development. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you do see that in the animal kingdom. Yeah. Like animals which are designed to overwhelm or to rely on quantity. Like rats.
More simple. They're more simple and they gestate quicker and stuff like that. Well, that's like a nigger. A nigger's like a rat. Or a locust, you know. More simple, breed quicker. They develop very quick. Their mother doesn't actually have to take care of them. They don't really have a courtship ritual. They just do whatever, you know, whereas white people have European courtship, which, you know, a man might court a woman over a few months, like dancing with her, making her the type of woman that he would marry. So that involves like chastising her a little bit to bring her into his way of seeing things, you know. So
and there'll be a lifelong courtship too.
Go ahead.
I just said it would be ideally a lifelong courtship. It would be for life.
Yep. And so when we have this sexualization of our culture, that's like their culture taking over, their like play culture taking over and encouraging young kids to just do whatever. And it doesn't work for our people. What we see with our people is that our birth rate drops and families are destroyed. And it destroys our society and culture. But with them, they're the plague type. So, that's their cult. That's what they do. They're fine with it. It doesn't affect them. It actually benefits them.
And the Judeo church is okay.
But with our people, it damages them. You know, living under the culture like that, under like a culture where people are just encouraged to, do what. But there was no marriage in Africa. There was no like this idea that a man and a woman get married and they create a family, have kids. That they don't understand rape. There was, the concept of rape just didn't exist in Africa. It's just do whatever, and then the woman gets pregnant, raises it alone. That's why in America they're continuing that same culture, which is a function of their genetics, where the father leaves. Like you have all these fatherless nigglets in America. Because they're just carrying on what they did in Africa. It's genetic. It's part of their little plague. It's because they're a plague species. It's genetic.
Makes a lot of sense. I've never looked at it that way, but it does parallel perfectly. And it's because they have the same objectives. Like another thing, a lot of animals which reproduce quickly and have very short gestation periods, it's because the animals have short lifespans, yeah. Either naturally or because they just die a lot, like they die young or something, like from predators. Yeah. And niggers die young,
yeah,
so they gotta reproduce.
And they do all this stupid shit and just die. It doesn't matter. And the Bible describes them as a plague, you see, and links them to locusts and stuff like that. But we're told we're going to live forever.
Yeah, so you're preparing yourself for an eternal life. You're growing up steadily. Smallest of all the seeds, the mustard seed.
They live for today and are gone tomorrow, and we're preparing ourselves for a kingdom. And so it doesn't matter what they don't care about the law or any of this stuff, brotherly love, because what's it matter to them? They're going to be gone tomorrow. They're not going to see the kingdom anyway. It doesn't matter to them. They just live for today, breed like a plague, whatever. They're not like us.
I wonder if anybody's ever done research in all the non-white cultures, because I wouldn't be surprised if none of them practiced monogamy. None. I'm sure they were all promiscuous.
Yeah, I'm gonna
Like, I don't know much about gooks or anything.